This podcast contains explicit material. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to season 2, episode 2 of The Joy of Text. Again, we are so excited about this upcoming season. Please continue to write in with questions, comments, any feedback to www.thejoyoftext.org. My name is Maharat Rini Smith, and with me on The Joy of Text are Rabbi Dov Linzer, Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Chovevei Torah, and Dr. Batsheva Marcus, President of JOFA and Clinical Director of Mays Women's Health. On this episode, we will first answer a listener question, and then we will be joined by Gila Muskin-Block to talk about an organization called Yesh Tikva. Our question for today is, I'm having a natural birth, and my husband has been great in practicing how to get me through childbirth. His rabbi is telling him now, though, that he will not be able to help me.
So this gets to the issue of when a woman is in the process of giving childbirth, she becomes a nida when she sees blood or when the baby emerges from the uterus. Obviously, the seeing blood comes at a much earlier stage. And when she's a nida, the general rules are not only that the couple's not allowed to have sex, but that they're not allowed to engage in sexual contact, and even non-sexual contact is one of the harchakot, the ways of distancing that a husband and a wife have to observe while the woman is in nida. So the question then is, well, then how can he provide the type of help in this context of natural childbirth, which will involve him touching her, holding her hand, massaging her back, and so on? So we should start by saying that many of the halachic decisors say it's absolutely forbidden. However, an objective look at the sources would certainly see that there's a lot that should be permitted. Already a discussion is that comes up early on, if a wife is sick, can her husband take her pulse? And while there were some that said husband cannot take her pulse, or there has to be some type of a cloth so he's not touching her skin when he's doing that, the halach has decided that something that is done for a medical need and that it's non-sexual touch, if there's no reasonable alternative, there's nobody else to take the pulse, or it's not a reasonable alternative, then the husband can. And that's that concern of touch would be overridden by the medical need. And that could be for one of two reasons. It could just be that we override restrictions sometimes for medical needs, but it also is that how much is it relevant now, this idea of them not engaging in certain forms of touch? Meaning, if the woman is sick and in nida, you could say, well, maybe they will have sex. But if the woman is in the process of childbirth, it's even a stronger argument because nobody is about to have sex while the woman's in childbirth. So there's a lot to say that for a normal type of a medical need, when nobody else is reasonably available, that the husband can do it. The problem becomes, and the reason that even the post-Kim authorities that acknowledge that, the reason that they hesitate in some of these cases is they say, first of all, there are other people who can do it. Why does it have to be the husband? Second of all, I'm not so sure that this is not a sexual touch, that this is neutral touch. You know, she wants the husband because there's a greater sense of intimacy between them. So there's a double reason why we shouldn't let the husband do it. And in my opinion, neither of those are good arguments. I think that, first of all, it is true she wants the husband because that's more comforting. And that's why somebody else is not an equivalent, is not a good alternative. And as far as the issue about, well, doesn't that make it more sexual? I think that's a big problem of the assumption that comforting touch or intimate touch becomes sexual touch. I really don't understand how they make that equation. Yes, you want your husband to be touching you and not some strange man or not even your best friend, but that does not make it sexual. And halacha clearly recognizes that specifically when it comes to a woman in childbirth, the woman in childbirth can eat on Yom Kippur, and we do a lot of things for women on childbirth to violate Shabbos, to override biblical restrictions, not just for what would be called an objective medical need, but for what's called yishuv hadas, for her emotional well-being. So to me, all of this is about her medical reality, I mean, helping a woman in childbirth, an emotional well-being in times when the touch is not sexual, in times when we otherwise would override certainly rabbinic, if not biblical, restrictions. So I really have a hard time understanding why so many people are strict about this. But I know that that's the fact, that the standard answer people get is that they are not allowed to engage in this type of touch.
Is this one of those cases where it's the rule and why there's the rule? The rule is you can't touch your wife when she's in nida.
Right.
And we know, or at least we think, that the reason is because you might come to some kind of sexual contact. So here is a situation where let's argue for the sake that there's no chance it's going to come to sexual contact. Right. But then does it still take away the you can't touch your wife piece?
That's a general question, which is when the reasons behind a rabbinic restriction are not relevant in this case. The general assumption is that you don't assess things case by case and that they're given sort of in a blanket way, which is why the argument I made, I added that as a contributing factor. But the basic argument is if there's a medical need and there's nobody else that can provide the same type of service, then the husband can provide the touch, certainly if it's not sexual touch. And that's even if sex is possible. So what it really boils down to is more not a debate of the halacha, but a debate of how do you assess the facts. People will say, well, another person can do it. And well, it is sexual touch. We're exactly debating the exact same phenomenon. The fact that she wants her husband because her husband's touch is particularly comforting to her. Right. Some people will say that exactly makes it sexual and that's why it can't be done. And I would say that is exactly why the husband is in a unique position to provide the type of support that she needs. I will say about this question about can context sometimes matter, that sometimes poskim do use that, particularly in these areas of harchakot. I'll give you two examples. One was there's an issue about a husband staring at his wife when she's naked, when she's anida. So the question is, if husband and wife are in a place where there's no mikveh attendant, they're by a seashore, and she's going to go into the ocean for going to the mikveh, can the husband serve as the mikveh attendant, make sure that she totally immerses, maybe check her back to make sure there's nothing on it, no chatzitzot, no obstructions.
And they're going to be able to have sex in 10 minutes.
So one of the poskim says, we're not going to apply the restrictions here because they're not about to violate and have sex 10 seconds before she goes into the mikveh. Another scenario would be Rav Avad Yosef was asked.
And so that's clear. People are clear about that.
Yes.
There's no discussion about that.
Well, I don't know if others disagree, but that is a well-known psak.
Okay,
Rav Avad Yosef was asked about the issue of a woman is anida under the chuppah. How can the groom put the ring on her finger if you assume that when the wife is anida, you're not supposed to pass things between husband and wife? So he says, and I find this ironic, he says, well, they're not about to have sex under the chuppah. They're in front of everybody, so that's not about to immediately turn into an act of sex, so that's a mitigating factor. And I'm thinking, if you ever needed a more romantic setting, and right afterwards they're going into the yichud room to be in private, but he's willing to say, since at that moment they're in front of everybody and they're not about to have sex, that's a mitigating factor to think that we don't have to apply that restriction. Now again, they
can
do this...
For a second? When you're chuppat nida, when you have your period at the time of your wedding,
right.
Do you actually do yichud by yourselves?
No. So what they do
so
is they...
never going to happen.
That's true.
Okay.
Thank you for that correction. Okay. That's absolutely correct.
No, it seems significant.
But the
romantic,
point, my
but
point
it can't
was,
be next to
no, but my
sexual.
Point was they would have an opportunity. If their lust would get the better of them, they could send... What you do is you have a little kid waiting in the room that's the yichud room, so they're not in private. So it's not like it's impossible for them 5 minutes from now, if they really wanted to act on it.
Okay.
Thank you for that clarification.
Okay.
But nevertheless, because obviously it starts with his issue of kavod habriyot, human dignity. You're not going to have a certain percentage of the chuppahs where the groom is not going to put the ring on the finger, right? So starting with that, then we're going to use this as a factor to be a mitigating factor.
But it does seem like a fairly safe, it sort of feels very equivalent to the childbirth.
Right, because the childbirth, it really is impossible. And in public, right.
Even more so because it's medically prohibited afterward. It's not like they're going to be able to find a 5 minute pocket where they're going to be able to have some time alone and be able to sneak in a quickie.
And you show me a woman who's going to be willing to have sex 5 minutes after she's a baby. It's just not going to happen. So it feels super equivalent to me.
I really have a hard time understanding why there's...
Why anybody has a restriction on this.
Well, I think part of it has to do with the fact that we go so extreme in terms of these distancing measures between husband and wife, so much more than we do between a normal man and a woman, even a woman who's anida. Think about the irony. Some posts were saying the husband shouldn't take the pulse, another man should.
Right.
Well, another man, she's not only anida, but a married woman to the other man, right? But because all these restrictions during anida are so extreme, that lends to this fact like they can never be violated. They're very, very weighty, and we have to find every alternative to them.
I was wondering, is this an area where people talk about this in a really strict machmir sense, but in reality, if you ask someone, they'll be a little bit more lenient, or this
no.
is...
No,
people are
no.
pretty... When I gave birth the first time, I was in Israel, and all I remember, my husband always jokes around about this, we had two midwives in Israel. It turned out, by pure chance, One was religious and one was not religious. And the non-religious one kept saying to him, come, look, look, look. And the religious one kept yanking the curtain shut. So he was like, people are really...
I know people are strict, but I know that there are some areas where the literature is more strict.
Right.
And if you come and ask personally a private question, that people might give you...
So I hope there are some rabbis that are giving leniencies. And I do know that in some written literature in Israel, at least, some rabbis are saying, if it's absolutely necessary, or maybe if you do it with a cloth, you don't directly rub her back. So they're finding leniencies, but in a limited way. But the sense I get, because I actually recently wrote something about this in brackets in some other thing I was writing, and I got an enormous response from a lot of women. Oh, I have to write more about this, because they say everybody is told you have to have hands off, that husbands cannot be helping their wives, even from the moment he has to get into the cab and go to the hospital. It's a real problem, I think. I'm sure there are some rabbis who are lenient, but I think overwhelmingly people are told hands off.
So what are we telling her?
I have to say one thing before you give the bottom line answer. I hate to be cynical, but this always reminds you of they want the fathers out smoking the cigar, pacing in the waiting room. Like, leave it to the woman to have the baby and don't involve the man too much. And I wonder if there's like a remnant of that. You don't think so?
I was wondering if it was the opposite way around. The men who needed some sort of leniency, if they would have been quick to change the halacha, but because it's not them.
I'm not sure we're saying different things.
I'll explain to you what I'm saying is different. So basically,
it was the man who needed his wife to do something similar.
Something
so
similar.
So I will say, not to feed into the cynicism, that in the discussion of the halacha about a husband attending to a sick wife, where there's all of these hesitations, when the issue is flipped and it's a wife attending to a sick husband, you don't find any of the hesitations. Nobody says if there's somebody else to take the pulse or somebody else to wash him. Now, the reason given is, and I believe that this is genuine, but I understand how it's so easy to be cynical, is that because a husband can more easily take advantage of his sick wife than in the reverse. So if the wife is sick and he's attending to her, then there's more of a real concern that that might end up with them having sex.
And frankly, my experience dealing with people is
that actually does happen?
Yes. I have women saying to me, like, I was sick. Nothing took advantage, but I cannot believe he wants to have sex with me. My nose is dripping off.
And you never hear the other way.
Never.
Right. But I think it's just because it's so weighty and to some degree so extreme that it tells people there's no way you can be lenient when they're really... I think it's a big problem that we frame this as being lenient. We're not being lenient. We're being... Reb Chaim Soloveitchik said he was very, very lenient in terms of overriding Shabbos to attend to somebody who had the slightest concern of a health issue. And he said, don't say I'm being lenient on laws of Shabbos. I'm being very strict on saving a life. And I think that we have to be just very strict on providing the type of emotional and in all forms of support to a woman in childbirth, and that's where our primary obligation is.
So your bottom line answer?
Is it's permissible. As long as it's not sexual,
right,
and as long as it's something that she needs from the husband and she wants from the husband and from no one else, then it's permissible.
Great, thank you. And now, a brief word from our sponsor.
Hi, I'm Shira Eliassian, a program manager with the Jewish Orthodox Feminist Alliance, here with an important reminder to mark your calendars for the 9th International JOFA Conference. Every 3 years, the JOFA Conference brings together over 1,000 people to deal with the foremost issues facing gender, Judaism, and Orthodoxy, from women in leadership and the Aguna crisis to sexual abuse and LGBT issues. This weekend is the event that generates the dialogue and thought leadership that will chart the course of the future of modern Orthodoxy. Become a part of the change and chart your course this year with JOFA. The 9th International JOFA Conference will take place on January 14th and 15th, 2017. Contact JOFA at jofa.org to get involved today.
At Maze Health, we know that if you are having sexual problems, it can have a significant impact on your life and your relationship. We also know that these problems are not all in your head, and it is important for you to know that pain, low libido, erection, or orgasm problems can all be successfully resolved. Maze is the only treatment center of its kind in the area, addressing both the physical and emotional sources of sexual difficulties. If you are a man or a woman experiencing sexual problems, please don't go another day feeling like there's no solution. Visit us at www.mazehealth.com.
Our guest today is Gila Muskenblock, founder of Yesh Tikva, an organization that works to provide navigational tools to those struggling with infertility and is dedicated to ending the silence around infertility and create a Jewish community of support. Gila, welcome to the Joy of Text.
Thank you.
Can you tell us a bit about Yesh Tikva, how the organization came to be?
Sure. I started Yesh Tikva to provide support to others who were going through a similar journey that I was. My husband and I had been struggling for about 3 years without finding a support network in the Jewish community. At the time, we were living in the heart of a young Jewish community in which people were having children, it felt like, every second. And we couldn't find the support that we needed, and we looked. And we knew that if we were going through this, that others must be also. And partially to provide myself with the support and also to help others who needed it, Yesh Tikva was founded to create that community.
Were you looking for emotional support, or were you looking for information, or what was it you felt like you were lacking, and what is Yesh Tikva
support? Jewish emotional support. There are many websites with information. There are doctors who are willing to sit and explain, and there are even support organizations that provide support to individuals regardless of their background. But there wasn't a Jewish support. A group that understood what it was like to be living in an insular Jewish community in which the pressure to have children was that much more prevalent, mm-hmm. and to understand what it meant to sit around a Pesach table when everyone was talking about Vehigadat Alevincha and you were the only one at that table without a child.
It was very poignant about you're looking around, everybody's having kids, and the pressure that creates. I also feel sometimes that there's this code of silence around it. So it's not just the pressure, but it's nobody acknowledges that it's happening. Did you find that that's true as well?
To a large extent. I mean, just from a personal experience, it took me a long time to open up. It took me 3 years to be able to even admit to others that I was going through it, mm-hmm. outside of my immediate family that I told earlier on. I did find support in my family, but in terms of support in the larger community, it was hard to find because it was something that people either didn't notice because 7 out of 8 women were having children naturally and easily, or just because people didn't want to hurt anyone by insinuating anything, mm-hmm. therefore they may not have reached out.
And what does the support look like? What does the organization do?
So we're a really new organization. We've been around for about a year now. Currently, we offer two aspects. We have a support through events and support through a pairing program called Fertility Friends. So Fertility Friends, under the direction of Dr. Talia Hinden, pairs individuals either who are currently both going on a fertility journey or someone on their journey with someone who's already found a resolution to their journey.
And that resolution may be choosing not to have children or to adopt or right. whatever the resolution
Any,
is.
Whatever the resolution is and whatever stage of the fertility journey, be it primary, secondary, circumstantial infertility, or any other path.
Recently, Yesh Tikva ran a 100 Shuls campaign, and you actually got more than 100 Shuls to participate in your campaign. So can you tell us a little bit about what this campaign was and what the feedback was from the communities? Were they eager to join Yesh Tikva and help you out?
And congratulations on reaching far more than 100
shuls. Thank you. The campaign was a huge success. We reached 120 shuls, which was beyond our imagined number. We were pleasantly surprised by the support that we received from the Jewish community. It was a non-denominational participation across all denominations of Judaism, of individuals coming together. The goal of the event was to raise awareness and provide support. It was to increase the conversation. The tagline was get people to ask, hashtag start asking. And that's what we were working to do.
So what form did that take? Did that mean the rabbi would give a sermon on the topic? Did that mean there would be a panel of people talking about their personal stories? Every synagogue decided on their own what form it would take?
There was a combination. The minimum participation was a message, 2 to 3 minutes of a rabbi speaking about infertility and sensitivity. It was Shabbat Rosh Chodesh Nisan because Nisan and Pesach's primary focus is around children, of, as I said earlier, Vehigadat Alevincha, which is one of the hardest times of year for individuals navigating infertility. Mm-hmm. And we ask that they share a 2 to 3 minute minimal message to their community about being sensitive to those in their community who are struggling to have or grow their families.
So that's the minimum, 2 to 3 minute message. What were some of the bigger forms that you heard?
So we had rabbis who dedicated their entire drashot to rabbis and communities who dedicated an entire Shabbat to it. Mm-hmm. So that included a Shabbat sermon in the morning, followed by a panel discussion in the afternoon where either the community members would participate and share their own journeys and stories, or another rabbinical member would share.
So I want to share something personal about that, at least about this Shabbat, which is that the synagogue that I went to, the Hebrew Institute of Riverdale, and I wasn't aware that they were doing this part of it, but considering the timing, they must have been. They had a panel of women talking about their own struggles with infertility. The show was packed. It was on Shabbat. When everybody was coming out, everybody was in tears. So it was so powerful. But then somebody said to me, should they have been doing this on Shabbat? This is the type of emotion you want to bring up on Shabbat? And my response was, you know, you're allowed to do certain things when they're seen as pressing communal needs. And if this would have been done some evening, besides that not as many people would have come out, but it wouldn't have been embraced by the community. It wouldn't have sort of made a statement about how the community is holding this in the same type of a way. So I think that that was in one way weird that there was that type of emotion going on Shabbat, but one way felt just so important that it had to be done. If I see a couple that's been married 10 years and hasn't had kids.
Three years as an individual?
Yeah, me as an individual. Okay, actually, it's interesting to hear how that might be a different answer. But yeah. Let's start with me as an individual. Okay. 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, they don't have any kids. Maybe it's a personal choice, but I'm thinking not. Should I, as a layperson or just, you know, a friend, go and say, like, I'm wondering, is everything okay? Are you guys struggling to have kids? Or is that so inappropriate?
I wouldn't recommend going over and just asking someone. If it's your best friend, maybe it would be different. As an individual, leave yourself open to allow someone to come to you and share their story. Be a listening ear. Be supportive. Just tell people that you care about them. Don't forget about them. At least personally, the hardest thing was feeling left out. As your friends start to have and grow their families, not being included in events, in get-togethers, or feeling excluded even if you're physically being included by conversations that revolve around family and children.
I know this is a sensitive issue, but because I do feel there's this code of silence, would you encourage people that are struggling with infertility to share more? If people feel comfortable saying, we're actually struggling with infertility, then I think most people are good, caring people. Yeah. So if they felt that that information was out there, they could respond in an appropriate way and they could be...
I mean, I don't think that there's a one mold fits all. I think that if a person's comfortable sharing their journey, it's important to share it so that individuals who are currently struggling silently because they're not yet in a place or may never be in a place to share, they do know that others out there are struggling. And at the same time, it creates an awareness in individuals who are not struggling to know that there is a community that is.
So what if I'm a rabbi and I see a couple in my shul that's 3 years, 5 years married, not having kids? What do you think I should
do? So a rabbi should reach out. I think a rabbi should reach out in a very sensitive way, in a way that doesn't force the couple to have to open up if they're not yet comfortable, but in a way that the couple or individual knows that the rabbi cares and when and if they are ready could share.
You talked about how being part of a young community and sitting around a Pesach table could be a difficult feeling when everyone around you seems to be having kids. And I've heard that social media can also be a source of tension, of difficulty with fertility. So can you just speak to your experience and how you've navigated social media around your struggle?
I won't post ever my daughter on Facebook because of that. My personal sensitivity, and I'm hypersensitive about it, I will never put a picture of her up on Facebook. As a sensitivity, I did not announce her birth on Facebook. I do not have any pictures, and I will not let my husband post any pictures of her on Facebook. That's my hypersensitivity. But that doesn't mean that other people need to. I guess just because that's how I chose to view Facebook doesn't mean that other people should or need to. I think that being sensitive is something that people need to take a step back and think before they post. If I were someone navigating any struggle, would I want to see a constant feed of this on my newsfeed? And if the answer is no, then maybe think twice before posting it. Maybe limiting the amount of times one posts images or messages that could be hurtful to any population.
So the one other thing I wanted to ask about the Jewish part is, are you looking for, you know, the irony about the fact that there is this code of silence is that the biblical stories, particularly in Bereishit, is that every one of our foremothers was barren.
Yeah.
And when does a rabbi ever talk about that when it's that Torah reading about that challenge? So the question is, are you looking also for Jewish sources to engage Jewish sources as a form of support? Is that a piece of this or not really?
It wasn't, but it may be.
Okay.
Right, and also the men. We're forgetting the men in this.
That's an excellent point.
It's not just the women.
That's right.
And we say couples and individuals, because we also know that it's not just married couples who struggle with infertility. There are also individuals who struggle with infertility who are either in the process of still looking for their soulmate and are struggling with what has been labeled circumstantial infertility. And there are individuals who are looking for that support because the emotional impact is very similar.
Could I ask another question? So, you know, when you talk about Jewish support group, when I think support group, first of all, I think about like 10 people together in a room. I'm wondering if you're looking into something like that in terms of local chapters that people can actually gain support by coming together as a group?
That is a goal that we're working on. Ah. We're just not sure in today's day and age if it's physically in a room
or
if it's virtually in a room, but it is going to be a face-to-face because something that we want to create is community, and community is created through interaction, which is different than any other fertility organization, even in the Jewish community, is that our motto is a Jewish fertility community.
Right.
We want people to not only know they're not alone, but we want them to feel that they're not alone.
Well,
great.
Thank you.
And now, a brief word from our sponsor.
Chovei Torah is proud of its new class of 13 rabbis, which brings our total to 108 rabbis now serving the Jewish community. Modern Orthodox rabbis making a difference in the world, in the United States, in Europe, and in Israel. If you think you have what it takes to be a Jewish leader and to be the next Chovei Torah rabbi, come visit us. Our website is www.yctorah.org.
To wrap things up today, the final word is
heteronormativity. So I can barely say it. And I'm going to use it specifically in the sexual context, which is it's a worldview that assumes penis and vagina intercourse. In general, it talks about a world that is only based on male and female traditional roles. But I think when it comes to sex, when we think of heteronormativity, we think of penis and vagina intercourse only, and that can be pretty limiting. What's your final word, Doug?
Well, I can't resist giving another parallel. So one of these days I'll have an unrelated final word. But I would say misolulot, which means to intertwine or rub up against. And that's the word that the Gemara uses to describe sex between two women. Two women who are misolulot zebezeh. Because it can't use the word having sex because there's no penis going into an orifice. So it is this term that's very vague and obscures the idea that this actually is a form of sex between two women. I want to say I appreciate the opportunity to have the final word of our final word.
No. That's cute. I like that.
I wasn't even planning on it.
It just came to you.
I actually really like this parallel.
Yeah.
I feel like I should come up with the word and then you should. It's a game.
What if I can't? And I want to say one.
If you have questions for the show or want to write in with comments, please submit them anonymously at www.thejoyoftext.org. Thank you to Gila Muskin-Block for joining us on this episode. The Joy of Text is produced by Jewish Public Media, which is supported in part by a grant from Next and Natan. This episode was recorded by Mike Hurst. You can listen to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or with any podcast app. My name is Maharat Ramey-Smith, and thank you for listening.